Thank you, Elliot. We've been using our Sunday evenings as an opportunity to train some younger ushers, a couple of junior ushers helping us out for that, and that's been a blessing to see them getting involved that way. You need a copy of the outline tonight. Wave your hand there. Brother Spidle will bring you one if you need one. As those there, we are coming to the third chapter of Daniel this evening. Let me get my microphone turned on here. In the first chapter of Daniel, we were introduced to four young, faithful Jewish men, probably no more than 13 to 16 years old, who were being held captive in Babylon. Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah. They had been taken probably as young sons of or teen sons of royal or aristocratic Judean families. They were among the first hostages from Jerusalem when Jerusalem was defeated by Nebuchadnezzar. While Nebuchadnezzar was still commander of the army of Babylon and not yet king, he was crown prince. His father, Nabopolassar, was on the throne, and Nebuchadnezzar was heir. After their transport to Babylon, they were among those selected for admission to an academy for training wise men, sponsored by the crown, training young men to serve as advisors in his court, many of those being foreign youngsters that were being trained to work in the court there, and also as hostages against the or to ensure the cooperation of the foreign countries they represented or from which they had been taken as hostages. It was probably during their first year in that three-year program that Nebuchadnezzar was elevated to the throne. And in the second year of his reign, while they were still probably no more than halfway through that three-year program, we learned something in chapter 2 that happened there. Now, chapter 1 ends with their graduation from that program, and they're coming before Nebuchadnezzar and his declaring their superiority over all of the other students. But chapter 2 recounts something that happened during their days in that academy that established Daniel's reputation as an exceptional interpreter of dreams. Nebuchadnezzar had a dream. We've talked about this. He didn't reveal it, or maybe didn't remember it. I think he just didn't reveal it to his advisors and told them they needed to tell him what he dreamed and what it meant. And when they couldn't do it, he was going to have them all killed, including the academy students, because there's no point in training more guys like those if they weren't any good anyway. And so the academy students are going to be executed as well. Daniel hears about the execution order, asks for an appointment to see the king, gathers his three friends, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, for prayer, and asks God to reveal to us something only God could know. And God answered that prayer. Daniel sang a song, and then the first thing he did is he went and told the executioner, "Stop the executions, I've got the answer." And the head of the school, the head of the academy, risked his reputation and his life by vouching for Daniel, took him to the king, said, "I found the guy who's got the answer to your dilemma." And Daniel then told him what he dreamed and told him what he meant. And we've looked at that. We spent 3 weeks looking at that that whole event about that great image that he had dreamed about, and Daniel told him that Nebuchadnezzar represented the golden head and all the various things of empires to rise and fall in the future from where they stood. There was the golden head, the silver chest and arms, the bronze abdomen, thighs, iron legs, the feet and toes of iron mingled with baked clay pottery or ceramics, ceramic tile, and God was showing through Daniel the progression, the coming progression of future Gentile empires. And then chapter 3 now, as we come to chapter 3, it jumps ahead in time by as much as 15 to 20 years. A lot of time has passed. We're well into Nebuchadnezzar's reign now. But he still remembers being told of God that he's the head of gold on that image. And he's always been an arrogant and proud king. And that shows that arrogance shows in this chapter more than it has in the other things Daniel has written about him. It's probably inflated thoughts of that image as he's been remembering what God had said, that he was the head of gold, that prompts the action that occurs right here. Daniel, interestingly enough, Daniel doesn't appear in this chapter. Daniel, at the end of chapter 2, was placed in charge of, he was given jurisdiction over the province of Babylon, which was the capital province. This happens in that province. This is under Daniel's jurisdiction. He had asked the king's permission to elevate his friends, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah,
better known in the text and to our memories by their Chaldean names, names given them by their Chaldean captors, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They have been given leadership positions under Daniel over this province. And so they are there, and they're the ones that around whom these events circulate. So they're key players in this drama here. Now, an interesting thing about this chapter is it really doesn't advance the prophetic message of the book of Daniel. There's nothing here that really shows us more about the progression of kingdoms, God's plan for the future. What it does do is it reveals some important truths about how God works, and it serves as an important parabolic illustration for Israel in captivity. God wanted to teach Israel something about his superintendence over them while they're in captivity. Instead of reading the entire chapter now and then breaking it down, I'm going to read it in sections as we go. So let's begin with a word of prayer. Father, we ask that you would bless our study of this portion of your word tonight. Lord, we want to understand correctly what happened and from a historical point of view, but also the significance and the lessons that we can learn from it. Help us to apply it properly in our hearts. Help us to be encouraged and strengthened in our faith and in our walk with you and in our love for you for having met together to fellowship in your word tonight. In Jesus' name, amen. Well, in the first few verses, we see that pride of Nebuchadnezzar revealed. He decides that he has become magnificent, so magnificent as that head of gold, that it's time to erect in his own honor a colossus, reminiscent of what he had seen in that dream those 15 to 20 years previously. And so in verse 1, Nebuchadnezzar the king made an image of gold. The height of it was 60 cubits and its width 6 cubits. He set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. Now, I'm not a huge fan of finding spiritual messages in numbers, in the numerology of Scripture, but there is evidence that God uses some numbers to symbolize various things at different times. A number that is often associated with man is the number 6, usually in the sense of man's fallenness or his rebellion against God. That is especially brought out in Revelation when it is used 3 times as the number for the beast, the mark of the beast, number 666. He says it's because it's the number of man. I don't think it's coincidental, although I'm not going to try to read too much into this, but I don't think it's coincidental that Nebuchadnezzar's great statue was measured in multiples of 6, 60 cubits high by 6 cubits wide. Nebuchadnezzar was the epitome of humanity, as it were. He was the head of gold on the image that represented earthbound, earth-centered kingdoms. Human kingdoms. And so it represents this is the greatest thing that man can do. It's interesting, I think significant, that that number is one short of the number that represents God and those things that are complete, the number 7. Everything man does falls short of the glory of God, even the best of humanity. That's part of the symbolism in the numbers. That's as far as I'm going to go with that tonight on the sixes here. This thing was huge at 60 cubits, about 90 feet tall, about 9 feet wide. By comparison, the famous, yet not yet erected, Colossus at Rhodes, the huge statue that goes by the name Colossus, was only 10 cubits taller. It was 70 cubits high. This thing was massive. But you understand this is an image that was erected more to be imposing rather than to be lifelike. To scale, a human being really isn't measured on a 10-to-1 ratio. Right, a 6-foot-tall man is typically a good bit wider than 7.2 inches at the waist. Right, not to mention the shoulders, but that would be the right ratio. 72 inches tall, 7.2 inches wide at 10-to-1. This is not a bookmark. It's something I cut out at a 10-to-1 ratio to give you an idea of the shape of this thing. It looks more like a totem pole than a statue of a man, a lifelike statue of a man. So it wasn't really intended to be a lifelike representation of Nebuchadnezzar. It was intended to be something that terrified everybody, which is essentially what a totem pole is supposed to do too, right? That seems to be the intent. It's called a golden image. It's doubtful that an image that size was solid gold. It was probably a wooden framework covered with plates of gold. That's not, the Bible's not being inaccurate there. It talks about the golden altar in the temple as well, but the golden altar in the temple, according to Exodus 37, verse 28, was a wooden framework covered with plates of gold. And it's very likely that this statue was built the same way. A statue that big, made of solid gold, would be almost impossible to, it'd be almost impossible to finance, let alone to establish a pediment that would support it. It would be incredibly heavy, and how would they? And it'd be difficult to erect. Nevertheless, we're not going to quibble over that, but it certainly looked like solid gold because it was plated with gold all over. And the point is that once the image was erected on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon, in the territory under Daniel's jurisdiction, Nebuchadnezzar then assembled all of his government officials. In verses 2 and 3, Nebuchadnezzar the king sent word to assemble the satraps, the prefects, and the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the judges, the magistrates, and all the rulers of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. Then the satraps, the prefects, and the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the judges, the magistrates, and all the rulers of the provinces were assembled for the dedication of the image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. And they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Seven classes of officials are ordered to gather to witness the dedication of this newly erected image. And I'm not going to try to parse what each of those classifications represented. They came and stood before the image he had set up. The repetition of the classes in specific, identical wording, you say, that's awfully redundant. Why does he do that? It illustrates, it's an intentional device, and it'll happen again in this chapter, to illustrate the absolute nature of Nebuchadnezzar's authority over his realm. The point is that he commanded specific groups to attend, and they all showed up exactly as commanded, and they did exactly what he said they were to do. It continues in the next verses. I'll say more about that as we go. He commanded then universal worship, as it were, of this image in verses 4 through 7. Then the herald loudly proclaimed, "To you the command is given, O peoples, nations, and men of every language, that at the moment you hear the sound of the horn, flute, lyre, trigon, psaltery, bagpipe, and all kinds of music, you are to fall down and worship the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king has set up. But whoever does not fall down and worship shall immediately be cast into the midst of a furnace of blazing fire." Therefore, at that time, when all the peoples heard the sound of the horn, the flute, lyre, trigon, psaltery, bagpipe, and all kinds of music, all the peoples, nations, and men of every language fell down and worshiped the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. So once again, we've got this repetition of a pattern. He's commanded universal worship. This was announced by a herald, probably more than one, so that everybody could hear him. But it was a proclamation that made sure everybody got the word. It described the signal that would notify everyone when it was time to act. This would be signaled by musical instruments. It was announced by a herald, would be signaled by musical instruments. It named six specific instruments and then a general category, all kinds of music. Included in that list are wind instruments, string instruments, and percussion instruments. Understand basically what this is the royal orchestra. And when the royal orchestra plays, you do what you're told. It doesn't tell us what they're going to play. Presumably, it's a piece of music that would have been associated either with public worship or, more likely, I think, the royal presence. In our context today, I think this would not be saying when you hear the national anthem, it's more like hail to the chief. It's the people were to respond out of respect to the king and show their obeisance to the king when they hear the musical signal. And all of these instruments are listed, and then they all played. And they were all required to bow when this happened. They weren't standing to salute. They were to bow down when they heard this. I don't know how much of this was an attempt to get the people to worship the king. The text is not abundantly clear on that. He has been told by Daniel that that the head of gold represented him in the vision that he had had all those years ago. And it may be that he's identifying himself with this image. But what he actually commands is they bow down before the image rather than himself. I don't know how much to connect him to the image. It's possible that, like Aaron with the golden calf, he's intending the image to represent the God who communicated through the vision. Nevertheless, bowing before the image was something forbidden for the Jews. because that was tantamount to giving allegiance to and paying obeisance to a pagan deity, a false god. Whatever the king's specific intent, the king was serious about this. He threatened death in the furnace for refusal. If you don't do it, you'll burn in a furnace of fire. Now, this might actually have been a routine threat, never expecting to have to enforce it. One of those things that the king says because he knows you're going to do what he says, and because he sounds tough. But it's not a bluff. He's still, we find out he's not bluffing here. It may never, he may have done this whenever he made any kind of a pronouncement, and he may have never had to toss anybody in a furnace ever before. Then all the instruments are listed the second time. They all played on command. We're told in the same wording used by the herald that when the orchestra played, everybody bowed down. And again, it's reminding us that these people lived in a culture where defying the king was unthinkable. That's the point of all this repetition. King says come, they come. King says play, musicians play. When the musicians play, king says bow, they bow. All of it's exactly according to the script. It's all going as scripted by the king. And to defy that and to go contrary to the script is almost beyond unthinkable. Right? Nobody does that. And so what we see next, though, is the character of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Now, the text calls them that. Those are their Chaldean names. I'm convinced they probably would have been preferred to be called Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, all those names that connect them to their god rather than to Chaldean gods. But we remember them maybe because the names are fun to say. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. But we remember them that way. And they're called that more often in here because this section of the book is written in Aramaic, and those are their Aramaic names. And so Daniel tends to be called Daniel more often because he's the writer. He could do that. He calls himself Daniel more often than he calls himself Belteshazzar, but that's the name they gave him, and he sometimes uses that too in this text. But right here, those are the guys we're talking about. And we know the story is about Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. But I don't want us ever to forget that they are really Hebrew people who had Hebrew names that were connected to their God. And they wanted to be connected to their God. And so that's the point of what we see revealed in this chapter, what we see recorded here. In verses 8 to 12, they were accused before the king by resentful Chaldeans. Let's look at what it says here. For this reason, at that time certain Chaldeans came forward. Remember the Chaldean, the word Chaldean is not just a reference to people who were the Babylonian subjects, but that's the word for that special class of wise men who were the chief astrologers, the chief magicians of the king. They're the ones who answered when the king, of all the classes of wise men brought in to try to reveal the king's dream, they're the ones who spoke up. They're the only ones that are quoted in the text. Well, they're the ones now who come forward and brought charges against the Jews. They responded and said to Nebuchadnezzar the king, O king, live forever. You, O king, have made a decree that every man who hears the sound of the horn, flute, lyre, trigon, psaltery, and bagpipe, and all kinds of music, is to fall down and worship the golden image. Once again, they're quoting the herald. But whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast into the midst of a furnace of blazing fire. There are certain Jews whom you have appointed the administration of the province of Babylon, namely Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, have disregarded you. They do not serve your gods or worship the golden image which you have set up. These resentful Chaldeans come to accuse them. The purpose of quoting the king's herald once again, further repetition here, is to make the point that not everybody did precisely as commanded. There were some who defied you. And these are guys who were important and who are supposed to set an example for everybody. And they're not doing what you said. And then when it says that they brought this as legal charges against a violator, the phrase translated brought charges against, that's a legal expression. However, literally, in the Aramaic, what it says is they ate their pieces. It's a picture of maliciously devouring the accused. What's A little ironic is that these Chaldeans owed their lives to Daniel and these three fellas, right? 15 or 20 years back, the king had decreed their execution when they couldn't tell the king his dream and its meaning. But when Daniel was able to do so, partly because these men were praying with him, Daniel had specifically, even before speaking to the king about what he had revealed, he specifically asked the execution order be stayed. These guys would have been killed and their families destroyed had Daniel not stood up for them. And it's not that he thought they were good guys. He knew they were pagans, they were worthless, many of them were even demonic. But he was defending them rather than having them slaughtered. Nevertheless, they have brought these accusations. So what I've said for the outline's sake is these men had been delivered by Daniel's revelation in 2:24. And while you might expect them to be grateful, we should remember that at the same time that he had them delivered, he completely discredited them. He proved himself to have contact with God and have communication with God they didn't know. And all of a sudden, they're irrelevant. They may not have been executed, but they sure didn't matter much to the king anymore because they couldn't offer him anything. None of their contacts in the spirit world could give him what Daniel and his friends could do through their God. They had been discredited by Daniel's revelation, and they had been displaced by Daniel's exaltation. When Daniel was elevated above them, he's an upstart teenager, for crying out loud. He's still a student at the academy, and he's in charge. And then he's got his friends in charge, and they're students too. That just isn't right. And they've resented it for 15 or 20 years. And now they've got something. I don't know how long they've been looking for an occasion to bring something against them, but finally the king hands them an opportunity. And so they come and bring their jealous accusations. Because they didn't like being subject to this man and his three closest associates who had no regard for their gods and no regard for their very profession. Well, the king responded exactly as they hoped. He was enraged. They phrased this very carefully so that it was not the king's fault, it's their fault. They didn't do what you told them to do. They have defied you, O king. In verses 13 to 16, then Nebuchadnezzar, in rage and anger, gave orders to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Then these men were brought before the king. Nebuchadnezzar responded and said to them, "Is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the golden image that I have set up? Now, if you are ready, at the moment you hear the sound of the horn, flute, lyre, trigon, psaltery, and bagpipe, and all kinds of music, to fall down and worship the image that I have made, very well. But if you do not worship, you will immediately be cast into the midst of a furnace of blazing fire. And what God is there who can deliver you out of my hands?" Stop there for a second. When Nebuchadnezzar heard the report that these three provincial rulers had refused to bow, he did not order their immediate execution. Instead, he ordered them brought into his presence. Now, as I've read this, we sometimes read it that way, and it sounds almost reasonable. Is it true? You do not serve my gods? I'm going to give you another chance. We'll try this again. Maybe you missed the signal. When they play, bow. If you don't, you'll die. Have you got it? Let's get it right this time. That sounds almost reasonable. I don't think that's how we should read it. Daniel used two words that it's easy to forget by the time we get to that part of the story when he introduced this segment. He used a word that means violent anger, translated rage, and he used a word that means fury, translated anger. This is a king who's barely in control. He is outraged in a way that's difficult to imagine. When an arrogant and never defeated king is outraged, that means trouble for whoever he's mad at. And he is violently outraged. This was not inquiry, nothing like a polite conversation. This was an interrogation that dripped with menace. I think it's better to read it this way. Nebuchadnezzar responded and said to them, "Is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the golden image I have set up? Now, if you are ready, At the moment you hear the sound of the horn, flute, lyre, trigon, psaltery, and bagpipe, and all kinds of music, to fall down and worship the image I have made, very well. But if you do not worship, you will immediately be cast into the midst of a furnace of blazing fire. And what God is there who could deliver you out of my hand? This was not a polite request. He was livid. He was fuming. He was furious. There's a sense in which he offered them a second chance for obedience. But it's the sense, it's kind of like in a much, if we wanted to trivialize it a bit, kind of the way a mafia don would give somebody who messed up a second chance, get it right or you're dead. This was a menacing threat. You bow, and I'll spare you for now. But if you refuse, I'm going to make a spectacular example out of your execution so that no one will ever again dare defy me. That's the intent of the king. He promised immediate death for disobedience. And this is not by a simple beheading. This is by imposing precisely the burning death the original decree had threatened. And then he claimed even God couldn't save them. You might remember that a few generations back, during the reign of Hezekiah, Jerusalem was besieged by the army of Assyria. The spokesman for the Assyrian army was he bore a name or title called Rabshakeh, and he made a similar claim. Isaiah 36:13-20 repeats it. It says, "Beware." Rabshakeh called out to the people of Jerusalem, "Beware that Hezekiah does not mislead you, saying, 'The Lord will deliver us.' Has any one of the gods of the nations delivered his land from the hand of the king of Assyria?" This is reminiscent of that. Don't think your God can deliver you from me. Nebuchadnezzar's willing to believe that Yahweh can predict the future, especially if he's going to call Nebuchadnezzar the head of gold, right? Nebuchadnezzar's willing to accept that. But he's scoffing at the idea that God is able to do anything to rescue these three men as they stand in his presence and under guard. You're at my mercy, I'll do what I please. You know, it's not just kings. There are lesser men than kings that have made the mistake of assuming that their human authority is greater than that of God's. That their human power is so great, God couldn't do anything about it. It probably didn't help Nebuchadnezzar's mood that these three men answered him without fear. They weren't cowering, they weren't groveling, they weren't trembling. They were respectful. But there was someone they feared more than Nebuchadnezzar. And a king like Nebuchadnezzar can barely tolerate somebody fearing somebody more than him. In verses 16 to 18, stopped it for 15 minutes ago. Verse 16 to 18. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego replied to the king, "O Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to give you an answer concerning this matter." That probably didn't go over real well, I got to tell you. It's almost like, who are you to demand us an answer? All right, that's how he's going to hear that, right? We do not need to give you an answer concerning this matter. If it be so, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the furnace of blazing fire. And he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But even if he does not, let it be known to you, O king, that we are not going to serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up." Okay, we didn't just not get the message. We heard the message. We just decided we weren't going to do it. And we get it. You're going to kill us if we don't, but that's okay. We'll die confident that we're serving our God, not yours. That's essentially what they're telling him. And this king is just, it's a wonder he didn't have a stroke right there. He's so angry. Now, when they said, "We don't need to answer this question," I don't know which question they're referring to. Because he's asked them two or three. He's raised two or three questions in his little speech before them as he's chewed them out. It may be the question concerning whether they served as God. But I think the question they really mean to answer here, at least most directly, when they say we don't need to give you an answer, is the final question about whether any God could deliver them from his hand, from his hands. But in actuality, after saying we don't have to give you an answer, they answered all three of his questions. All right? They did, in fact, give him an answer to all three. The question about whether or not they would serve his gods, whether or not they served his gods, they answered very clearly when they asserted God's superiority. They said, our God whom we serve. You know, there's a distinction between your gods that you want us to serve and our God whom we do serve. And it isn't your God. That's communicated very clearly in the language here. Our God whom we serve. They asserted God's superiority. It underscored the answer that they wanted to give the king. When they said, particularly the second part, when they emphatically concluded by saying, let it be known to you, O king, at the end, we are not going to serve your gods. It's not that we just didn't, or that we forgot, or we missed the message. We're not going to. Or worship the golden image that you have set up. So not only were they not going to serve his gods, they were not going to obey his command. But then they answered the other question, the final question, whether any God could deliver them, especially, it's interesting, they expressed their confidence that God could deliver them. If it be so, or if he chooses to do so, God, our God, is able to deliver us from the furnace of blazing fire. And he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But they didn't promise that God would do that. They stated their confidence God could, but God had never told them he would. And so they weren't going to put God on the spot and say, yeah, God can keep us from dying in the furnace, or he can keep us out of the furnace. There are a lot of ways God could have kept them out of the furnace. Lightning bolt could have struck Nebuchadnezzar dead, and they never got tossed in. There are a lot of things that could have happened. But they weren't, God had never promised that, but they said that even if he doesn't, we're not going to worship other gods or bow down before this image. We'll die in the furnace rather than have that happen. Rather than give in. They expressed, thirdly then, having first of all asserted God's superiority, secondly, they expressed their confidence God could deliver them, and thirdly, they expressed their commitment to obey God, even if he did not deliver them. That's, by the way, very important for us to understand in facing challenges in our lives today. There are those out there who tell us if you just have enough faith and you claim it, name it and claim it kind of a theology, if you just ask God, claim it with enough faith, he'll give you what you're asking for. He'll heal you of this sickness. He'll heal you of that thing, or he'll provide this way, or he'll do this or do this other thing. God has never promised to do those things for us. What he has promised is to bring us from the grave in glory and give us eternity with him, and that's a better promise. Right? And what these three young men understood is that God could spare them from a furnace, but if he spares them from a furnace, they'll eventually die anyway. What's more important is when they stand before God and hear him say, well done. Because he's promised them that one day. And if I got to take one or the other, I'll take the furnace today and face my God. And that was their confidence as well. They didn't ask for a miracle. They expected no miracle. They were faithfully resigned to the will of God. As Job said in Job 13:15, though he slay me, I will hope in him. That was their confidence. God might kill us today. This might end our lives, but that's okay. We'll trust him. Verses 19 to 23, we read the rage of Nebuchadnezzar. The rage of Nebuchadnezzar. He was filled with wrath. Their dedication to God, their lack of fear, sent the king into a mindless, almost blind rage. Then Nebuchadnezzar was filled with wrath. His facial expression was altered toward Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He answered by giving orders to heat the furnace 7 times more than it was usually heated. He commanded certain valiant soldiers who were in his army to tie up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in order to cast them into the furnace of blazing fire. Excuse me. Then these men were tied up in their trousers, their coats, their caps, and their other clothes, and were cast into the midst of the furnace of blazing fire. For this reason, because the king's command was urgent and the furnace had been made extremely hot, the flame of the fire slew those men who carried up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. But these three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell into the midst of the fire, the furnace of blazing fire, still tied up. Then Nebuchadnezzar the king was astounded and stood up in haste, and he said to his high officials, "Was it not three men we cast bound into the furnace, into the midst of the fire?" They replied to the king, "Certainly, O king." And he said, "Look, I see four men loosed and walking about in the midst of the fire without harm. And the appearance of the fourth is like a son of the gods." Then Nebuchadnezzar came to the door of the furnace of blazing fire. He responded, I'm skipping ahead. I'm going to stop right there, verse 25. He was filled with wrath. But this wrath produced, I'll put it this way, his wrath produced folly. Had the king calmed down and thought about it, he probably would have done things a little differently. But in his fury, his first order to his servants was to heat the furnace seven times hotter. Now, that's probably a bit of hyperbole. Don't know what the furnace normally burned at, but seven times hotter is unlikely. In actuality, they probably wouldn't have had sufficient or the right kind of fuel to produce that kind of heat, seven times hotter than it might normally be. But the truth is, if he really wanted him to suffer, it would have been far more torturous to tie him to a stake and build a bonfire under him and roast him slow, instead of tossing them into this superheated oven. He's almost guaranteeing they're going to die a much faster, a much more merciful death here. Very likely, it's very unlikely they would even survive proximity to the furnace, as we see happening to the soldiers, let alone the actual contact with the flames. They're going to be dead before the flames get them in a furnace that's this hot. It's also interesting that I think he kind of unintentionally honored them by assigning his most valiant warriors to bind them. His best soldiers he assigned to execute them. I think, wouldn't it be more insulting to order privates to tie them up than generals? If the generals are the ones to do this? As the scenario unfolds, I think it would have proven less costly to the empire also, because those guys all die, the ones he sends to toss them into the furnace. Further, in his furious haste, he had them tied up in place as they were. The text very specifically describes their formal dress. They were dressed in the official finery they'd worn to the ceremony. He bound them up in their clothes of office. It would have been more humiliating to strip them and bind them up in rags or throw them in naked than to throw them in all their robes of office. But he doesn't. It's possible that he intended that that he was executing them as high-ranking government officials in order to show that no one's rank could protect them from the wrath of the king. But if his goal was to humiliate them, which seems to have been the case, it might have been more effective to execute them as disgraced traitors to the crown, which he never did. He just bound them up in their robes of office and had them tossed into the fire. It's going to be important when they come out, still wearing those robes of office. Okay, it's going to be helpful, but nobody anticipated that. So tied up like this in their clothes of office, he ordered them cast into the furnace by those most valiant soldiers, all of whom died. The death of the executioners was the result. Persons he intended to execute didn't die. The people who were carrying out the execution were the ones who did die. By the way, their death didn't just cost the kingdom its best military men, it also proved the sufficiency of the method of execution. If the heat of the furnace was so intense that those who approached close enough to toss in a victim were slain by it, then the possibility that the victims would survive was nil. It was only by divine act that anybody survives this. There's no conceivable human way for a victim to cast into this furnace to survive. All of these details that the king in his fury, the king's fury served as the foundation, if you will, or a backdrop against which the power of God is displayed. Proved and underscored the power of God in verses 24 to 30. First of all, he looked in and in the furnace, he saw four men. Instead of three, there were four. This power of God was displayed while the prisoners were in the furnace. That's an important lesson for us too. We think God's power is displayed if he spares us from the furnace. He could have spared them from the furnace in a lot of different ways. He never spared them from the furnace. He had them in the furnace. You want to know the power of God, you'll sense it, you'll find it while you're in the middle of the affliction, in the furnace of affliction. The power of God is best demonstrated under fire, whether metaphorical or literal here. But instead of three men, there were four there. The Chaldean word Eloh, used here like the Hebrew word Elohim, translated God. They're both plurals. It usually means gods in the plural. When used for Yahweh, it's usually translated as implying the triune nature of the one true God. But since this is a pagan king speaking, it's more likely that this translation is accurate here, that he means the fourth looked like a son of the gods rather than the son of God, the son of Yahweh. That's not likely to have been something Nebuchadnezzar was thinking about at the time. There was something about this one that impressed him as divine, though. But it's also possible that this is an example of God using a man, an unwitting speaker, to say more than he realized. That's happened before, too, in other contexts. I believe that this fourth person was a theophany, an Old Testament appearance of Christ prior to his incarnation. The text isn't abundantly clear on that, but I think that's who this, we're intended to understand that that's who this is. The spiritual point of the fourth man in the furnace is to remind us that God is always with us, even in the furnace of affliction. And I would say, especially in the furnace of affliction. That's when we sense his presence. God was with these young men all the time, but he only manifested himself in the furnace. That's when they saw it. That's when they recognized his presence, right there in the middle of the flame. But as the king looked in there, not only did he see four men, he saw, instead of bound men, instead of three men, he saw four. Instead of bound men, they were loose. The flames had destroyed the ropes that bound them and hadn't damaged anything else. The ropes burned up, they were fine. The spiritual lesson in this is that earthly bonds are temporary. And they're ultimately ineffective. But furthermore, the king also said that instead of dead men, they were walking. Those guys should be dead. They should be burned. There shouldn't be anything but ashes left of them by now. And there they are walking around in there. How can that be? There's a sense in which this shows us that even execution isn't the end. It's liberation. The Apostle Paul faced death, desired, but to depart would be far better, because even execution would be liberating. He was looking forward to being with the Lord. And again, we see, I think, part of what this is intended to illustrate. But besides God's power, the furnace is also when there's problems with injury, even any evidence they've been in the furnace. Verses 26 and 27, then Nebuchadnezzar came near the door of the furnace of blazing fire. He responded and said, Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, come out, you servants of the Most High God, come here. Then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came out of the midst of the fire. The satraps, the prefects, the governors, and the king's high officials, I love the fact it's repeated again, gathered around and saw in regard to these men that the fire had no effect on the bodies of these men, nor was the hair of their heads singed, nor were their trousers damaged, nor had the smell of fire even come upon them. I think it's interesting, first, that they didn't come out from the furnace until the king commanded. He said, come out, so then they could come. They had permission to leave. This command they could obey because they emerged. The king officials, again, all of them were required to attend. They were all there to witness this event, so this wasn't something done in a corner somewhere or secret. This is something everybody's going to know about because they were all there. They gathered around. All of them attested. They were armed off. Nothing, even, they didn't even smell of smoke. I can't grill a hamburger without a light. These guys spent some time in the furnace and they came out even smelling of smoke or ashes or fuel or anything. No more changed were they than if they'd been walking. The whole incident is a parabolic message to the immediate audience in their context, Israel in captivity. God wanted them to know that he was with them in the midst of the furnace, that their bonds were temporary, that they would emerge unscathed as a nation. He was still on his throne. He was going to keep his promise. But for you and for me, it also demonstrates that nothing temporal can really harm us. We may have to go into the furnace. We may not emerge from the physical furnace. But even the furnace can't destroy us because our God is on his throne. And we will be with him, emerge glorified in the resurrection. There's a picture of that in all this. And this is also the power of God, thirdly, is shown in the king's response. See, verse 30. Ezra said, "Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and delivered servants." Angel is a word that means messenger. "Delivered servants, put their trust in him, violating his command, and yield not to serve any god except their own God. Therefore, I make a decree, any people or tongue that speaks anything offensive against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be torn limb from limb in their house of sheep, inasmuch as there is no God able to deliver." Then the king caused Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego prosper in the province of Babylon. He had sentenced them to the furnace, and the furnace had some tried them by some other method. Nebuchadnezzar, I think, even in his fury, had some honor, but he was also terrified of this God who he had just defied and couldn't deliver you. This, he delivered him to the furnace. I don't think he wanted to try anything else at this point. He's kind of had his momentum checked in all of this. He had witnessed the miraculous. He's decided they're no longer criminals for serving Yahweh instead of his gods. In fact, he doesn't want this God on anybody else's side. He wants to be on the good side of this God as much as he can be, because this God has demonstrated a power he never expected. He proclaimed God's superiority. "Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego." In fact, earlier, when he called them come from the furnace, he called them the servants of the Most High God. "Yeah, you defied me. You said you wouldn't serve my gods. You're serving him, and I guess it's paid off for you. You're the servant of a God who is more powerful than mine. And so come on out." And then he's now made this proclamation that he said he credits them with having put their trust in him, even to violating the king's command, you bought a selling to die any other God. Honors them for that. He went so far as to issue this decree that prohibited any people, nation, or tongue, anybody in his realm, whatever their ethnicity, whatever language, were, they must not speak anything offensive against their God. This is not conversion. I think that's later. I think Nebuchadnezzar gets converted, but I think it's later. I think it's not yet. What this is a terrified man recognizing, here's a God I don't want angry with me. And you better not provoke him. All right? And so he issues a decree, nobody in my realm better say anything against this God. This time the penalty wouldn't be death in the furnace, it would be death by dismemberment and destruction of the property, which was precisely the death penalty he had pronounced for the officials who couldn't tell him his dream 15 or 20 years before, if you go back to chapter 2. Prior to consigning Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego to the flames, he had asked with mockery and disdain, "What God is there who can deliver you out of my hands?" And now, in his official proclamation, he says, "There is no other God than theirs who's able to deliver this way. Theirs can, even though no other can." He's not converted, but he wants God on his side. Chapter 2. Chapter 3, separated by as much as two decades, Nebuchadnezzar has learned in chapter 2 that Yahweh can reveal secrets no one else could reveal. Now he has learned in chapter 3 that Yahweh can deliver. God is preparing him to understand something vital so that Nebuchadnezzar will be prepared to be converted. That's going to happen later. But having been delivered in such a spectacular manner, then this chapter closes with Nebuchadnezzar having promoted God's service. The scheming of the Chaldeans had backfired. When he says he caused, when the text says that he caused them to prosper, that has a very broad meaning. It includes socio-political prosperity as well as material prosperity. The implication of the statement, I think what we should understand this to mean, is that these three men became wealthy powerful and influential in the province of Babylon to the end of their days. I believe that's how we should. We must assume that this chapter promises us deliverance from every threat. It does not do that. It does not promise you'll trust God to deliver you. It shows us that God doesn't deliver us. It's because it isn't because he couldn't do it, it's because of another person. What this chapter does is it illustrates that we may have to endure the furnace of affliction, but even through the furnace, we'll emerge glorified in the power of resurrection. That's the primary application for us today. Let's pray. Father, we thank you for your paid before Nebuchadnezzar and Heschel through the testimony of Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Lord, I pray that we might live with such confidence in you that we would dare defy such an order and face death in confidence, Lord, that we are yours. You are working things according to your will and for your purposes.